From New York City, the world-famous Comedy Cellar presents Live from America Podcast. Live from America Podcast. With Noam Dorman and Hatem Gabber. Live from America Podcast. Where the top experts in the world and the best comics in the nation get together weekly to discuss today's issues as they cover news, culture, politics, comedy, and more with an equal part of knowledge and comedy. And now, here are your hosts, Hatem Gabber and Noam Dorman.
I mean, Noam Dorman, owner of the Comedy Cellar. And this is Live from America Podcast. And if you are listening, consider watching us as well on our YouTube channel, Live from America Podcast. Three amazing guests. Boris Harkin is here. Welcome back from touring around, comedian and podcaster.
That's right.
That's right. How's Bushwick Great Bears podcast going?
It's not. I was almost going to say something and then I didn't. We're taking a little bit of a break.
Okay. But your episode is still there. Also, our guest of honor, Elise Lobot, is here. She's a columnist at Foreign Policy Magazine and professor at American University School of International Service and longtime CNN Global Affairs correspondent. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. And Walker Bragman, he is a journalist with the Daily Poster. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you guys for being here and looking forward to have a great conversation. So 9/11, 20 years, you know, I kind of want to cover a couple of things, you know, I feel that's very important. Not a lot of people are talking about it. But I want to know where you guys were. I always like to ask that question. 9/11. What's your memory of 9/11? Let's start with Elise.
Well, I was working for CNN at the time. I covered the State Department, and I was walking in. I was in my car, kind of, or in the taxi, and I heard that the first plane hit the tower. And I thought it might have been some kind of air traffic control error, and thought it was horrible. But then, as soon as I heard that the second plane hit the second tower, I knew that there was, you know, some kind of attack. And I was going to work at the State Department. I walked into the State Department where I had a little office, and the building was being evacuated. And so everyone was running out. I was running in trying to get on the phone with CNN. I was one of the last people to leave the building. Thankfully, it turned out that, it was evacuated as I think there was a false alarm about a possible another plane hitting the State Department. So then all the State Department press corps were trying to make their way to another building where the Foreign Press Center was, which was kind of far away from the State Department, and they kept blocking off the roads. So what could have been like a 5-minute road was really extended because the perimeter kept being extended. So it took me about 2 hours to get there, but that's when everyone started kind of reporting, and there were briefings coming out of there.
Yeah. And Walker?
Well, definitely not as harrowing. I was in eighth grade at the time, and I remember that I was walking into my social studies class, like you do, and my best friend stopped me in the hallway and said, "The Twin Towers got hit by an airplane and are collapsing." And I remember saying, "If that were true, it would be much bigger news and a much bigger deal. Like, go to class and stop worrying about it." And I turn into my classroom, and on the TV, one of the towers had already fallen, and it was just, yeah. And then my teacher asked, you know, "Who do you think did this to everybody in the class?" And we all went around with our, you know, very, very not informed eighth grade ideas of what was happening. I think China was one of the guesses, and my teacher said I think it was Osama bin Laden. None of us knew who that was.
Oh, he did say that?
He did. He did.
Oh, wow.
And that was the first time I'd heard his name. So,
oh,
yeah. Cool. So that was my experience. We all got to go home early that day.
Boris.
Wasn't a total loss.
I was in high school, and I can't remember a ton, but the one thing I do remember is that they did not tell people. They purposely did not tell the kids, and they called the students whose parents might have been in danger down to the principal's office or whatever individually, and they hid it for I don't remember if it was the whole day or but enough that people were pretty pissed off afterwards that the school handled it that way.
No, you were in D.C., right?
Yeah, I was in D.C. trying to do something on the DL with a girl. And I was remaining incommunicado. And my phone kept ringing and ringing, and I wasn't answering it. And that was a whole ridiculous, funny, screenplay-worthy story about how I got caught with miscommunications there. But yeah, I was in D.C., and I didn't find out about it until a few hours after it happened. But I will say that one of the things that I remember is that after it happened, I was walking around D.C. and I walked to the White House and there was nobody there. There were no guards. There was nothing. And I started to walk up to the door of the goddamn White House. And then all of a sudden I realized, this is probably not something I should do. But it was a surreal, I Am Legend moment where everybody had just evacuated. They had no protocol and they left. I mean, maybe there was a human being there somewhere, but everything as it seemed to me, I could have walked right in like a January 6th insurrectionist. Anyway, so that's what happened to me.
So I was the only one in New York.
Suspicious attack.
I know.
Of course you were.
So one of the I read a great article, and we would discuss it actually yesterday when we were doing a special show about 9/11 as well, in the New York Times, about what does it mean to say never forget, because a lot of people just say it, it's posters everywhere, stuff, but what does it mean, especially, which we're gonna discuss later, is there's a whole new generation now that didn't even experience anything about it. At least we, I know Noam, after he got caught, came back to New York, and you remember the smell, you remember,
oh, yeah,
the feeling, you remember, walking around and for miles and miles and all that. And there's a whole generation can't even, it's not their fault, obviously, they not experience anything. So what does it mean to never forget? And what should it mean to never forget, at least?
Well, I mean, I think it's meant different things over the years, right? I mean, in the beginning, it was about kind of terrorism and never forget what America stands for, and also never forget, which I think this is one thing that's kind of been constant. It's never forget the heroic activities of the first responders and just ordinary people that were helping everybody evacuate, that were helping the families in that day. And the idea that America kind of stood united. And I think today, when you heard President Bush speaking, making parallels to what's going on in this country about the division and the polarization and kind of white supremacists and hatred, and he was making parallels to that, that we need to remember how united America was on that day. And I think we've forgotten all of that. And that's what I think today, obviously there's patriotism, never forget the lives of the U.S. military service members lost over the years. Never forget all the first responders and also the brave passengers of Flight 93, right, who made the conscious choice to retake the plane. But I think now it's about young people, especially young people who were born after the attacks, need to know that terrorism is real. But also the idea that Americans all united together, stood together patriotically, saluting the flag and the enduring spirit of America, which I think is pretty much lost right now.
Walker?
So when the attacks first happened, and never forget was definitely about, remembering the lives lost and the sacrifices made. Today, I think of it a little differently. I think of it as sort of perspective not just for the Americans lost, but the hundreds of thousands of civilians that, you know, we retaliated against and killed overseas in response to this attack. I think it also means not making the same mistakes that we made following the attacks. I mean, we turned a national tragedy into a commercial movement to buy and you know, there was a political cartoon that somebody posted from the period where it was like fighting terrorism at home and abroad, and the at home was shop till you drop. I mean, to me, it's pretty obscene that happened. And I think we launched multiple wars, privatized those wars, made a lot of money for you know, defense contractors and just the staggering amount of life that's been lost since in the two decades since is just you know, that for me is what Never Forget is about, because the next Osama bin Laden has probably already been born. And, you know, blowback, we sort of reap what we sow, and that's, you know, I wish that we had kept that in mind, but we didn't have the leadership at the time. We didn't have the perspective, maybe, and as a country we were angry, we were hurting, but it's been 20 years and we really need to have it now.
Boris?
Well, clearly it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I think overall, the sentiment is obviously, you know, like Elise said, to keep in mind heroic acts and sort of like a national identity. I think that's still a thing that's sort of necessary for anything you want to do as a country. I will say, you know, my exposure to it is kind of seeing what people post online. And there's a lot of now, particularly actually friends I have who were there and who kind of saw it happen. And there's a lot of like asking people not to post like photos of the towers falling and not to post like what could be re-traumatizing to people, which I think is interesting. Although my perspective is sort of, if that's a thing that's going to make you uncomfortable, you should probably just not log online for the day, because for a lot of people, posting that is a way to deal with it, and it is a way to keep in mind the heroic acts and whatever it is. So I think there's a little bit of like weird, I know this isn't directly answering the question, but I think it's maybe a more interesting contribution, that I think there's a little bit of like policing now over like what other people should post or what it should mean to other people. And like, obviously it's going to mean very different things. Obviously you're going to have people who on the one hand are far extreme and see it as, you know, America good guys, terrorists bad guys, and you're going to have, you know, Twitter left or whatever other extreme that's like, we are the terrorists, that's what we should keep in mind, you know, like it's going to mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But I think that at a certain point it's going to need to like unite people if we're going to have a country. So it's going to need to mean at least something about like something good about America, or, you know, we're not looking at a great path.
Yeah. No.
So the question is, what does Never Forget mean? Tell me the question exactly.
Yeah, what does it mean to you, and what should it mean?
Well, I mean, I would just ask you, first of all, maybe I'm out of it. Never Forget is a expression I associate with the Holocaust.
And is that Never Again?
Or never Again? I don't know.
It is confusing. They're very similar.
Yeah. But the Never Forget doesn't immediately ring 9/11 in my mind. That might be my own.
No, that's definitely your own, yeah.
Form, but I mean, I would not, I mean, there are so many, there's any number of incidents in American history, significant incidents that you would wish we would never forget. 9/11 is just maybe the most recent one. Maybe it just, you know, all can be put under that umbrella of that famous, you know, those who don't remember the past are, you know, destined to relive it. We do see this more and more, where we are complacent about threats that we were at one time at 100% consensus of their importance. I'll give you just one example as an analogy. So when the Soviets put missiles in Cuba in 1962, whenever it was, 63, whatever year it was, there was a basically a universal agreement that this was a threat worth going to war for. Now when it looks like it's very likely that Iran may end up with nuclear weapons aimed at the United States, it looks like we're going to acquiesce to that. And I know that the first thing that comes to mind is, well, it's not as close, but the geography really doesn't matter, right? I mean, the distance between the missile and the United States is not the point. The point is that a less reliable, less stable, more bellicose, and less likely to have any fail-safe measures and procedures and all this stuff is ready to, and with more powerful weapons, is about to probably threaten the United States with the very same threat that we knew in the post-World War II shadow was unacceptable. And we don't see it as unacceptable anymore. So that's kind of like, you know, that what happened to never forget, you know, the past has become figuratively a black and white movie that just doesn't seem relevant to us anymore. And it's not, it's just not, it's going to come back again. And
so,
again.
So you're saying that never forget sure reminds of the threat.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't think 9/11 is particularly a never forget. I think the concept of never forget is much deeper than just 9/11. I don't know if what I'm saying is stupid or smart, but that's just, you know, what comes to mind. Like, what do we never forget? Never forget the heroics of 9/11. Well, is that an unusual thing in American history? Heroic people who gave their lives? And I mean,
I'm sorry. Respectfully.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm Jewish too, and I had family in the Holocaust. So, I mean, obviously that's a moment in time that, you know, we can't forget about, and obviously that's an instance, as you're right, where, you know, if you forget the past, you're doomed to repeat it.
Yeah, you're right. It's never again.
But I think we're getting hung up on the words never forget or let us remember, whatever. We're talking about 9/11, right? This is the day after 9/11. This was like a seminal moment in American history where everybody living in the country's life has changed dramatically in so many ways since that day, from what you were saying about walking up to the White House, to taking a plane, to the Department of Homeland Security and how hard it is for foreigners to get into this country, to the threat. I mean, it's a moment in time that like everybody's life changed. So
I don't disagree with you. I'm responding directly to the question of, that's why I asked him to rephrase, what does never forget mean to me? And when I think of never forget, I see 9/11 as yet another one of the very, very important incidents in history that the lessons have a shorter half-life than we wish. I don't think it's a unique event in terms of us not learning and heeding the lessons. Yes, it's if we all have PTSD having lived through it, but that's part of the flaw of never forgetting.
But I really think we didn't listen.
How do you get our kids to feel the visceral relationship to it that we find easy because we lived through it, you know?
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. That's why never forget should have a great meaning.
Yeah, because never forget extinguishes with the last breath of the person who lived through it. It's how do you teach these things? How do you boil it down? And that's what we're terribly bad at. It's how do you get the people living today to understand that the wisdom of the people who didn't want
to. But if we can understand ourselves by not even able to define what we cannot forget, how can we teach it? You know, that was my point. Which way, Walker, go ahead, you want to say something?
Yeah, I think you can distill down the lessons that September 11th has taught us, not to descend into xenophobia, and not to rush to sacrifice, civil liberties in the face of fear, in response to an attack, not to privatize war and.
But
can I say one more thing to defend myself? I didn't mean to interrupt Walker, and then I want to answer. Go ahead.
Oh,
go ahead. Keep going, Walker.
I was just going to say, and also, you know, to be aware that there is, you know, that the world is a dangerous place, but that doesn't mean we should lose, you know, the values that we claim to stand for in this country, which are, you know, equality, you know, and democracy and just we have in 20 years after this event, I mean, it's hard to say that we've learned those lessons. I mean, it is difficult for me to look at this country and say, yeah, we've come a long way since then. I mean, we are still very extended abroad.
Well, that was the reason we were attacked in the first place, right?
Exactly.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to discuss, I wanted to say something. Go ahead.
So I would say the lesson I'll never forget to try it all together in my, you know, ass backwards view of this is that what was the lesson of the 30s was to take these threats very seriously before it's too late.
Yeah.
And that was a lesson that you heard people, I remember it, people who were worried about Al-Qaeda prior to 9/11 with the tower, the first attempt on the towers and then the U.S. call and the embassy in Africa. And people saying, we need to do something about this now. But the lesson wasn't learned, right?
Yeah.
And this is the same lesson that people that we learned the hard way in North Korea, and we may end up learning in Iran, and it runs full circle now to we're ready to reset the chessboard back to Afghanistan and the Taliban and safe haven and put all our faith in this over the horizon solution from the same people who told us that the Taliban would never take over Afghanistan, and same people told us so many things in the last few years.
So not
true. We're going to put all our eggs in that over horizon basket. I think we're not learning the lessons. There's a lot of lessons we're not learning here. And as far as our values, I agree with you very much about the values, but I would only say that in the Second World War, which was, I think we all agree, a righteous war, we messed up our values in certain ways there too. The firebombing of Dresden, the internment of the Japanese, but it can both be true. It can both be, true to our values, and at the same time recognize that in these very hot times there can be excesses. As a matter of fact, there always will be excesses, I would say.
The pursuit of threats abroad creates those threats abroad,
and they also save lives.
Yeah,
but in the end, did it? I mean, ultimately, we were in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now the Taliban is back in power. I mean, this is...
Let me ask you guys this question. You experts.
They're a new progressive Taliban.
What's your view of the counterfactual? If we had just done nothing after 9/11, would that have been the last attack?
I'm not saying do nothing. There are things that we can do that like don't involve regime change and trying to nation build abroad. Like that's like that what? Creates that creates like the what? Very problem. Like stepping up security at home, like being more cautious at home,
how do you secure against airplanes coming into the town?
The Taliban offered the United States, they offered to turn bin Laden over very early on after we bombed, and then they made an offer and we didn't take it. And
You're right about that.
But yeah. I mean, that's a mistake.
The American president said, listen, the smart thing to do here is that we're going to step up security. He would have been.
You can't stop like a group of people plotting destruction abroad in a basement somewhere. You can't.
But we did for 20 years. We did.
But we
haven't we? Honestly, I mean, factually.
Look, there's a difference between going into Afghanistan and getting bin Laden and, you know, kind of ridding Al-Qaeda and spending 20 years there. Yeah. Trying to end the insurgency.
Can I try to bridge the gap? Can we all stipulate that there are tens of thousands of Afghani women in Kabul who would say, no, you have this wrong. You guys saved our lives by coming in there for these 20 years.
Yeah, but that was not the mission. That was not
really the mission. We're talking about morality here. We're talking about the morality.
Okay, but I want to stick with 9/11. So let
can
me
I connect?
Just and it was the mission, by the way. It was
right,
the mission.
So let me just say this quickly. I think that Never Forget should be three things that I agree with Elise in, like, how united we were at that point. And also, we need to understand the threats that we ignored, like kind of Noam and Walker both touched on, that led to that event. And then the education. Why are we telling people what they feel? And how can we actually give them the picture? We cannot give them a picture of saying, like, oh, we should not have gone to war, because we should. But like Elise said, we should have got bin Laden in and out, you know, and that just really responded very harshly to whoever did that, and then out, not change regime or anything like that.
We're forgetting Saudi Arabia still, though, just like we have been. Yeah. I want to say two things. One is that, like, I don't think it's black and white. Like, even with World War II.
Wait, Boris, hold on. Something wrong. I just realized, no, the Taliban didn't offer us bin Laden. We offered the Taliban, if they would give us bin Laden, we would walk away, and they refused. Yeah, well, that's exactly backwards. The Taliban never offered us bin Laden.
It wasn't the Taliban that offered us bin Laden. So the Sudani government offered bin Laden
before 9/11.
Before 9/11, the Sudani government offered bin Laden. Or the other topic was to move him to Afghanistan. And we said, move him to Afghanistan.
There's a Guardian.
We offered the Taliban to give us bin
Laden. There's a Guardian article.
Guys, please, we need to focus. I really want to do this about 9/11. So let's just focus on that. Boris, go ahead. You want to say something?
Okay, yeah. I actually have a good analogy. The only thing I was going to comment is just that, like, the nation building thing isn't black and white. Like, we nation built in Japan and Germany after World War II, but they're homogenous populations. Afghanistan, we're like dividing it based on our point of view. Like Vietnam, like communism versus anti-communism, when it's like much more complicated than that. They have different ethnic groups, they're, you know, that side with different things. Sometimes nation building works when we understand the area the way that it actually is, rather than based on our own point of view. But I was gonna say a better analogy, I think, is COVID right now, personally, because even post 9/11, everyone, like we said, was very united into going against the common enemy. I think in hindsight, we recognize that we compromised a lot of values. We compromised our civil liberties and in the process. And I do think now with COVID, we're similarly tribal, where I think valid maybe criticism or just valid caution regarding compromising certain, I know I'm representing like what's automatically tribally now, a specific point of view, but I think a lot of times people who seem hesitant or critical over certain civil liberties that we are compromising under a moral guise of fighting a pandemic are being lumped into tribally someone who's either, you know, doesn't give a shit about the pandemic or whatever else it is. I think there's some analogy there that people don't want to humor or want to lump in tribally those who right now might be concerned while fighting COVID, similar to post 9/11, that we might be compromising certain things.
Okay, but it is political, because all those people vaccinated their kids to go to school. Like, it's a political... I'm not saying there aren't anti-vaxxers or people that believe that antibodies are better than taking a vaccine. And I have people in my family who are among them. So I don't...
Wait, the latter there is true. And actually, antibodies plus vaccine is the best case scenario, according to the...
Okay, well, I'm not a doctor and neither are you. So
that's true.
But Dr. Boris...
Yeah. Well, you made a claim. I'm just responding to...
Okay, but what I'm saying is that most of the tribals that you're talking about right now... This is all related back to the political argument about COVID and about this particular moment in time with a pandemic in this country. It has there are people that are vaccine hesitant. The vast majority of non-vaccinated people are doing it out of a political argument.
Sure. I think both exist.
This talk of like, okay, I assume we're talking about the mandate, right? The get vaccinated if you work at vaccinated or get tested once a week.
Whatever. I mean,
nothing specific. I just think the conversation devolves into tribal arguments very often.
Yeah, but the civil liberties discussion surrounding this is inherently a tribal argument, because we lost more people than died in the terror attacks on 9/11 on Thursday alone, this past Thursday. Like this is a national...
I saw you tweeted that, but that's
health,
like,
emergency.
But it's true.
It's such a silly academic, like, oh no, it's such a hassle for me to either get vaccinated or get tested once a week. No, I'm sorry. Your desire to, you know, that academic discussion doesn't factor into my right not to get infected.
You're picking a specific thing, and it's a perspective I didn't even take. To be clear, I'm vaccinated. But I'm not saying against mandates or anything in particular. What I'm saying is, like you said, the conversation devolves politically, and I think it's still worth having a rational discussion over what it is that we're compromising with any sort of laws and not automatically devolving it into that. And I will say the whole, more people died yesterday. You could do that with anything. You could do that with heart disease. You could do that whatever else. They're not things to be
compared. You can't do that with everything else, though. Why not?
How many people die in traffic accidents every day?
Spread exponentially? Did you get in a car accident and then your friend came over and then caught the car accident?
It doesn't work that way.
That's not how viruses work.
But why is that the metric? All I'm saying is
the metric is because 650,000 people have died in the last year and a half at minimum. And those numbers, epidemiologists agree, are likely undercounting. We have a national public health emergency, and there is a role for our government to act and address that. And if we can't do it, we're really screwed because climate change is already here.
I don't disagree with any of that. But you could speak about terrorism the same way post 9/11 to shut down a normal, non-emotional discussion of it.
You can't, though. Again, we had 3,000 people die on 9/11. We had more than that die on Thursday.
All right, they're both bad.
Why is it a competition? That's crazy.
So let's just, if we can, because we have a little, I know we have four amazing brains, love debates, but I really wanna get a lot of you guys regarding that topic. Elise, you're like an expert in foreign policy and all that, and I really wanted to talk about the events that led to 9/11. And do you see any similarities in now, like in policy? And that will be the same question for Walker and Boris and Noam when he comes back.
Well, actually, I think that if you look at what the reason that bin Laden had this kind of hard on for America was because of our adventurism overseas and our support of, regimes such as the Saudis, for instance, or others that were oppressing their people. And so they kind of saw the U.S. as the big boogeyman in the region. And they thought that if they could destroy the U.S., that could overturn the whole kind of world order in which, Muslims were oppressed. And it was less of a kind of international world order based on regimes, but more, turn it into kind of more of a religious type of looking at this. And if, the Abbottabad papers that were found with bin Laden when he was killed say that the entire Muslim world was subject to the reign of blasphemous hegemonies, which is the United States, right? So in the 9/11 attack was intended to kind of break the fear of the US and destroy its invincibility. And so, I would say it did the opposite, because that was like the beginning, as we've been discussing, of all this adventurism overseas. So I would think America did, as Walker was saying, like America didn't really learn those lessons, because then we went into Afghanistan, then we went into Iraq, then there was this whole kind of, war on terror. So I think, the reasons that the U.S. was overseas was really the reason for 9/11. I think right now, someone like Joe Biden might understand that and so wants to kind of pull back. I don't know if that's necessarily why he wants to pull back. He wants to look at other threats like China, which is a whole nother story, or domestic concerns. But the end result is there could be less anger towards America from global jihadists. I'm not talking there won't be other terrorist threats and other anger in America for not doing enough.
Yeah.
But I would say the terrorism that we were attacked with on that day, in this day and age when America's retreating, might be a little bit less.
Yeah. I just want to say something. I'm going to focus with Elise a little bit more because she has a limited time. She has to go. We can stay a little bit longer so we can have more conversation. But I totally agree with you. Being from that region, I know that the terrorists use the American president as an agenda to get more terrorists. Like, look, they occupy, especially with the new generation, just like there's a new generation here that didn't see 9/11, there's a new generation there that doesn't understand why America's there, and they don't have access to internet or anything like that. And it's like, oh, they're killing us. They this. So yeah, I totally understand.
But let me pose another question to you though. If you look at some of the drivers of terrorism today, it's global instability. It's like all these restrictions that were put on because of COVID. It's global inequality and poverty and climate change and all these things. And then I bet your bottom dollar that a lot of these countries are going to be like, where is the United States? Why
absolutely
aren't they helping us? Yeah. You know, those areas of instability are going to lead to weak governance, and they're going to lead to, I'm actually writing about it for this week, like they're going to lead to also instability and safe havens for terrorism. And then those countries are going to be like, oh, well, you know, we're in this, you know, shit situation. Am I allowed to say this on that podcast?
Yeah, yeah, you can say whatever you want.
Where is the United States? So
yeah, absolutely.
The U.S. is a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a blessing if it's just in and out. But I'm saying the agenda of the terrorists, that they use the occupation sometimes and stuff like that.
And but they also our presence, our lack of presence worries me less than like bombing a school bus full of children. As a
being a little bit literal. I mean, you're
no. I understand. I understand your point. I think it's a fair point. But it does. I have to say, weighing.
I'm not saying we should be bombing children.
No. I'm not I don't mean to suggest that you are. I take your point, and I think it's a fair point. Between those two polls, the you know, our presence and our lack of presence being blamed on us, I think I'm more worried about the things that we actually do.
Can I ask Elise a question? Because in any time that somebody does something terrible and they say the reason they did it is because you did something. And so you say, well, if you hadn't done that, but that can't be the end of the consideration. It has to be specifically, you know, well, was I wrong to do it? Did I not have a right to do it? Just because you don't like it and you think that you're going to kill 3,000 Americans, that's a pretty dangerous precedent to set in terms of giving people a veto power by the threat of
doing something. I totally agree. I'm not saying it was right. My question is,
if you could wave a magic wand in American foreign policy on the issues that Bin Laden claimed to have cared about, what would you not have done that would have kept Bin Laden happy? Would you have?
I'll tell you what I would have done. I don't know.
What would you not have done?
Well, I would have not paid. So it goes back to what I would have done. I would have paid less attention to military adventures and
like which one specifically?
Military support. Like there was a lot of support for the Saudis.
We needed the oil, didn't we? Didn't we need the oil, especially back then? Wasn't that? I mean, what would have happened in America if the Saudis had fallen?
I think there was less attention paid to strengthening governance in those places, having those regimes.
That's why we went to Afghanistan, was to strengthen government.
Well, they didn't do that, though.
I'm saying it's not so easy to do. So we
probably didn't say it was easy to do. I just said that they didn't do it.
I'm saying we have to.
That it wasn't good enough.
We have to live within the world of reality and practicality. We have to say, well, okay, if I had been president in the 70s and 80s when we were getting all our oil from Saudi Arabia, would I have sat back and let them fall because Bin Laden doesn't like it?
I wouldn't have sat back and let them fall, but I would have said, you have this problem with your people. In order to not fall, you have to do A, B, C, and D, and we can help you with that. Instead of just giving them, I did it. Everyone's saying like that won't work. I didn't say it would work. I said, that's what needed to be done. And if you look-
Even if it wouldn't work?
If you look in
Afghanistan, who knows if it would have worked or what would have not? You know, like this
look in Afghanistan.
That's right. Who knows if it would have worked? Who knew that?
So let her answer the question.
Building couldn't work.
All right, but you're asking her an impossible like question that doesn't really have.
I guess let me make my point in a different way.
Make your point.
Hindsight is 20/20. There's a remarkable amount of Monday morning quarterbacking that goes on here based on how we sit back, wait to see how it turns out. And if it doesn't turn out well, say, see, these idiots didn't know what they were doing. I think that we have to judge them more based on the time and place that the decision was being made.
I would say that the U.S. repeated the same mistakes in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, now Tunisia, across the Sahel, which is that they overemphasized the military part and they de-emphasized the governance part. So we went in, we bombed Libya, we went in, we bombed Iraq, and we did all of this stuff without ensuring that there were governments in place that were responsive to their people. And that's why That's why the Afghan government fell. It's not because they didn't have, you know, didn't know what to do. It's because they didn't want to fight for Ashraf Ghani. And that's the same in Libya.
Yep.
There wasn't a strong government that was left in place. And so we're not, the U.S. is not learning from its mistakes. And that's the way you don't kill a million people. You just, you build them up or you, and it's not nation building. It's called state building. And it's in helping countries govern themselves. And that's what we're not, we seem to throw billions of dollars in aid in Haiti, but why are there successive coups?
I'm gonna bridge
not this. Paying enough attention to the actual governance piece. And that's what we didn't do.
I think you guys are actually more in agreement.
We can't
than
solve
it
our own social problems. It reminds me of when Kamala Harris said, well, I'm gonna fix the immigration crisis. We're gonna get rid of those gangs and the corruption in Costa Rica. I'm like, we can't get rid of the gangs and corruption in our own country. We can't make progress on the crime issues where we have crime issues in this country. To think that we can make progress on the deep-rooted problems that you describe in foreign countries is so idealistic.
Deep-rooted, these governments couldn't provide their people with clean water. Like, this is, you know, this is like a basic thing.
We're not able to do it here, and we're not able to do it there. We're not good at it.
So a little humility is in order in terms of what the options really are. The options really are not the
option is
to
bomb them instead.
Yeah, wait. Humility with what we can and can't do, so we're going to go in and topple their government and be like, sorry, we left you with a mess, but like, look, we got to be humble about what we can and can't do. Like,
we've done that in other
humility
countries.
Would be not toppling their governments, not going in and toppling governments and thinking we can build new ones when we can't even deliver clean water here in the U.S. I mean, look at Flint.
It's not as if every time we've done this has been a failure. It wasn't a failure in Japan. Wasn't a failure in Germany. As a matter of fact,
with the whole world,
it took a while, but it was not. We didn't.
I think you guys are saying the same thing.
It was very successful in South Korea.
So, Boris, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think Elise is describing more of what your ideal is, Noam, which is dealing with the world the way that it is. So if you have a complicated situation, and again, like I said earlier, Japan and these are homogenous. We had a much better understanding of the population in general. Whereas, again, with, you know, most of the Middle East in general, where
50 years ago or even more. I'm not good at math, but
right. It's a very different context.
Long time ago.
Yeah. And so the world is different, but also just in general, we're projecting less of our own like fake map of what the territory is over a group of people that's just not in line with it the way that we think that it is. So I do think it's not dealing with the world the way it is to go in and think we're going to establish a new government where like our map of the territory is so far as the people's ideals. Even Afghanistan, you know, I think if you ask some of the women that are like Pashtun farmers in the hillside, they're not necessarily going to think of Americans as coming in and liberating them, because it's just the set of values is so drastically different. I don't think it's that simple to just be like, surely they understand we're heroes here coming in
I was saying when we compare Germany and Japan experience to Afghanistan, that means we have no understanding of the region or the people at all. You know, if you think that the same value, the same religion will, you know, oh, we succeeded here, we're going to succeed there. No, you don't. You're not going to. You need to understand how people look at you.
I maybe I'm the most idealistic one, but I quite think it's reasonable at least to say that if the youngest person in Afghanistan that had experienced the brutality of the Taliban and the alternate counterfactual of living in a brutal dictatorship as opposed to the relatively free country, at least in the cities that it was, if the youngest person who had that comparison in their head was 60 years old instead of 20 years old, if we had stayed the course, I don't know that a country where the youngest person who ever lived in a without freedom was 60 years old, it'd be so easy to put that genie back in the bottle. I don't know.
Yeah, these countries, these people in Afghanistan, I mean, and I have an article in Foreign Policy about this. I think the Afghan people are going to surprise us because they didn't have the Arab Spring when the Taliban was in power last time. And they've seen countless amount of countries stand up for their rights and stand up for their freedoms. And now you see Afghan women in the streets.
Yeah.
Testing. You see,
unfortunately not.
Now you're supporting the American. Now you're saying the American policy.
No, she's not saying that.
I never said
Afghan women have done that. If America had
no, yes, they have done. You're not giving enough credit.
Are you kidding me? Wait, you can't. You can't take. the Arab Spring and say this is because of America.
All right, let's at least finish her point.
No, Walker, the Americans did. I mean, Norm's right. Like, America did a lot of wonderful things there. It also did a lot of fucked up things. I mean, it's not a monolith. Yeah.
No, I'm just saying you can't take an organic, like, movement of taking the actions of people that live there and crediting ourselves for that. That's
no, but there is
not a lot. Crediting ourselves, but America still does deserve credit for the progress that was made over the last 20 years. These people didn't do it all themselves. Yeah. They did it, but they did it with U.S. help. I mean, it's not either or.
Absolutely. It's not everything that we've done is bad.
Walker,
I think
I'm
we helped a lot.
I'm surprised you won't. Listen, when Cuba and Hong Kong, was it, when they protested in the streets, they wave American flags. You should not roll your eyes and underestimate the power of American ideas. Even, you know, we at home think we're this racist, anti-immigrant, blah, blah, blah country. And yet all over the world.
Yeah, that's right.
People want to come here. The movie It's a Wonderful Life. If you imagine the world without America and its ideas, do you not understand the dystopian, most likely dystopian alternate universe you'd be imagining?
And he's right. I mean, if America doesn't lead, nobody else does. So,
and the value,
under the current paradigm, that is true. But I mean, look, we are just notoriously terrible at like doing the thing that we went over into the Middle East and North Africa to do. I mean, look, you can even take an example not in the Middle East. Look at Russia and our presence in Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed. We tried to build, we got Boris Yeltsin reelected. He was our, you know, we sent our economic advisors over there.
I'm going to have to disagree as someone who came over here from that Russia. There was a lot of improvements during that time period, specifically under Gorbachev. It began even before the collapse, and America's presence helped free up a lot of economic opportunities, and it helped me get the fuck out of
there. Well, when you say free up a lot of economic opportunities, I'm assuming you're talking about the mass accumulation of wealth by a handful of oligarchs at the expense of, I mean, 7 million people died between 1992 and 2007. That is a staggering number of people.
You're comparing this to a fake vision in your head where nothing goes wrong in a Soviet Union where America is not involved. Literally, I am able to be in this country because America helped influence the Berlin Wall to fall and helped that country. If there are people, not just oligarchs, I agree with you. There's a ton of corruption still. There's a ton of oligarchs. There's a ton of accumulation of wealth. But there's also my parents who were able to purchase their apartment from the Russian government for $2,000, or my grandparents rather, resell it to then be able to start a life here with $10,000, which is
a
big deal.
And that's great. But the government that we set up was so unpopular and so damaging that it resulted in Putin. I mean, like, you want to talk about
Walker, I'm sensing something.
To Denmark, Walker.
The alternative to Putin is not a good government.
Want to say one thing. Boris said, I'll let you know. No, I'm saying, but I just
don't ask Walker a question. I'm going to stipulate that everything that you've said is true for the sake of argument. And imagine that if we're organizing a debate and you take the anti-American side, these are the things you would say. Now, I'm just curious because I get a vibe, and I just really, and I mean, this is a sincere question. If you had to tell people the good things about America and the things that you would take pride, if that's the word, or that you just would be happy about America's influence in the world, what would they be?
Our promise. That's an easy question to answer. The promise of this country.
Something else. In other words,
the promise is, you're saying it's an empty promise.
I think it
has
been. I think largely.
So let's circle back. Never.
Wait, you asked me a question. I'd like to answer it. I would like to answer it. You asked me a question. I think the best thing about America is what we aspire to be, and that I think is a real thing. But in actuality, when we have, you know, tried to when we've overextended ourselves, when we try to build up governments, when we try to create the world in our image, we have never succeeded. And we'll never succeed.
What about that accomplishment? Say that when asked, aside from something, you know, esoteric, you were not able to come up with a single example.
No, you're asking me to say to something espouse about, like, what are the good things about American hegemony in the world?
Don't. I say hegemony. Yeah. Oh, come on, don't put words. I say like.
But that is what you're referring to.
You could say we defeated fascism and basically.
But we haven't defeated fascism. We haven't even defeated fascism in our home country.
How about this one? Hold on. It's an easy one. It's an easy one. How about this one that America did for the whole human nation? Vaccine. How about that? In 8 months.
That's a good one.
That's great, but we're hoarding those vaccines. We're not supporting the TRIPS waiver. Look,
but they wouldn't exist at all.
But okay, but what good is a vaccine that's not being distributed?
But it eventually will be distributed.
But I just
eventually, after how many, mutations of this virus?
If I had influence with the State Departments of every country in the world, and I could arrange a passport for you, seriously now.
Elise, go ahead. Elise, you want to say something?
Singapore. Singapore is great, Noam. Most valuable passport in the world.
I just want to say something, and then I'll let...
I think everyone made good points, but none of this is black and white. Like, America has a lot of flaws. And I'm the first to say it, and I write about it, and I have, you know.
But I will say firsthand, the fact that the Soviet Union is your example of where America's influence, it's to me straight false, but at the very least, no, not you, Elise. I was responding to Walker earlier, describing America's influence in the Soviet Union. From my personal experience, it's very false, having my grandparents survive a famine there and seeing the progress when I was a kid of even just speech, even like moments I've spoken out against Grandpa Lenin, whose portrait we had on our school, and that progressing to a point where I was brought home from my dad's
work. No doubt that America helped.
Right.
Helped kind of give way to the, I mean, but it wasn't the only one responsible.
Totally.
Everything it didn't do was good. Everything it didn't do was bad. And I mean, I think that, you know, from Norm's spectrum that, like, you know, America doesn't matter whether it's good or bad, like who else is going to do it? And Walker, they shouldn't do it because it never turns out perfect, is the middle ground where, I mean, American leaders.
It's not that it doesn't turn out perfect. It's that we kill hundreds of thousands of people, and that's considered slightly imperfect. But America still, we're still good. The question of whether America is good or bad, as far as I'm concerned, is irrelevant. It's a question of what are we doing? Are our policies working? And when we define success on policy,
Walker, wait.
When we define a policy's success as by the human cost, I think we would have a very different estimation.
What's the policy without a human cost?
No, it was a human cost. He's right, always. But that doesn't mean it wasn't.
Right, I mean, I'm saying it's always the case.
Yeah. We could have an hour each on the Iraq war and the war in Afghanistan and all of these other things.
And I just want to say one thing. Hold on. I want to say one thing. It's very important because the only one from actually that region is like, yes, there's a lot of people that were killed, but there's a lot of people that were saved. I know people that will be say, just drive, not me, fortunately, but people will be just drive until you find an American flag and you will be alive. Some people were handing their babies to the American soldiers. So you cannot just say this is not the greatest country in the world. Yes, we've made mistakes, a lot of them, and people, innocent people died. But just to be fact, at least have to go. And I know, you know, unfortunately, you have to go. It's really great to have you. We got to do this.
Proud American with also great humility.
Yes. At least you want to share your contact information before you go?
At least you have to leave this second, really?
I got a couple more minutes.
Okay. This is going to devolve into madness without you.
So let me just say a couple things because this is a great panel. First of all, Hatem makes a very good point. You have to, if you can imagine what it means for a mother to throw her baby to strangers, never to see that baby again. That can tell you quite well.
She's not throwing to strangers, throwing to the flag of the United States.
Yes, but to strangers. And we can tell you quite well what they on the ground foresee as the alternative to America's presence there. And that's humbling. Number one. Number two, as a matter of perspective, what Boris made me think of, it is worth remembering just this very conversation that we're having. The freedom to have it is unprecedented in the history of the world. And this, and to the extent that they have these conversations anywhere on planet Earth, it's a direct chain reaction to America. And so, Walker, what I was really kind of get to is, say, of course, listen, when you hear that 100,000 or 150,000 civilians died in Iraq, it's a stunning number that has to make you say to yourself, surely there was another way. Surely this didn't have to happen. You know, like these numbers are breathtaking. But the cost of inaction in Syria, for instance, was 500,000 or 600,000 dead people that were not at American hands. And throughout that part of the world, there's hundreds of thousands of people dying in tribal war, nothing to do with America. And that is also, when you see that, you say, isn't there something we could do to stop that? You know, and then you get there to try to stop it, and then you end up killing. So these are very, very, very complex things. And if you approach them, this is what I fear about you, Walker. I don't know you and I don't want to insult you. But when you approach them with a bias that clearly that you have, which you don't seem to be taking internal cross-examination measures against yourself to steel man the other side of these arguments. Clearly you're coming from a point of view where you have a beef with your country, and fair enough. But the lack of perspectives just seems stunning to me, that you think that there's only one side to these things. America,
I think it's what you're saying is profoundly arrogant, that we look at the wrongs in the world and say we can do something about that. You know,
we have corrected wrongs in the world.
And the last example of a moral war you can point to is World War II.
Okay, let me ask you this. The millions of people in Korea living fulfilled lives. And fulfillment is really a nice way to look at it, because before the 20th century, very few people had any fulfillment in their lives. It was just misery, beasts of burden existence. When you look at those people in Korea having fulfillment of their lives, and then look at those people in North Korea starving, and you can't see that America is the difference between those two outcomes. And you can't, and by the way, a lot of fucking people died, both Americans and Koreans in that, and civilians in that process. But to look back on it now and say, no, nothing good there. Nothing, we had nothing good to show for it. That to me is a distortion born from, forgive me, a hate. That's not rational. Is that you cannot look at that outcome and say, "Oh, no, there's nothing for me to, nothing there gives me pause."
So we will have Walker respond to you, but before we go, that at least we have to go. So I'd like to give her the last minute just to say your final thought and your contact for people who want to follow you.
I think everyone has. I think everyone has good points. In my work, it's not like one or the other. It's just kind of connecting all the dots and putting all the things in the puzzle. I think that by and large, America, as Walker said, has a lot of promise. We don't necessarily always live up to that promise, but we try. I'm an equal opportunity offender and really non-political. I mean, I think the last Trump years was a little different because it's a total anomaly. And I don't think he was fed a typical ideological model, but generally I have criticisms for everything, every president, what they did, what they didn't do. And I do think that we have promise. We don't always live up to that promise, but I think where we lose our way is when we don't do what we say we're going to do. And we kind of limit it to, maybe we're bad at single sales objectives and then following through and realizing them. I think Afghanistan is an example. I think Iraq probably was a misadventure, but at the end of the day, as Norm said, we did save a lot of Iraqis from brutality from Saddam Hussein. So none of these are either or, right? We went in with I think we always, most of the time, go in with noble aims. A lot of times we lose our way. But I think that I'd love to go back to what George Bush said yesterday, which is, terrorists at overseas and terrorists at home, they're different in their ideology and where they stem from their hatred, but there is a lot of hatred in this country. And I think that the main thing is to kind of listen to the other person, and maybe we didn't do such a good job today. But listening to one another and seeing that we each have valid points, we may not agree with each other, but there is some common ground in the sense that we do want to, you know, move forward. It should be us against the problem. It shouldn't be us against one another. So yeah. More on that next time.
Yeah. And your Twitter, please, because I love following you on Twitter.
At Elise Labatt.
All right. Thank you so much. I'll be in touch. Guys. Yes. Thank you. Agree.
Okay. Take
thank
care.
You. Have a good one. Okay. Walker, we'll give you a, you know, you need to respond to what Norm says if you like, you know, or just,
I think it's a profoundly arrogant viewpoint. And it typically, when people say abroad, you know, Americans are arrogant, that's what they're talking about. This idea that, oh, there's a problem. We can fix it. You know, the Korean conflict was a proxy war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the first place.
So not the Soviet Union, China.
Soviet Union as a fucking, like, the spread of communism. Yeah, like, look, it's...
Chinese people fought. We actually fought Chinese in Korea.
I know we did. I know. Not the Soviet Union. Yeah, but it was... Okay, yes. But where... Okay. Whatever. I'm not gonna sit here.
It's a basic fact, and maybe
it's widely understood as a proxy war between the Soviet Union and the U.S. A difference in ideologies, you know, communism versus free market capitalism. Our version of the version of capitalism that we install when we go abroad, when we intervene in places, is not a version that benefits the people largely, and that is seen throughout our history. You can go back to the, Yeltsin's government, where he was privatizing everything and people were miserated, high rates of death, millions of people.
I disagree with all of that. But
the numbers don't lie. 7 million people died in Russia between 1992 and 2007.
The numbers
they turned to a strong man to reverse policy. Afterwards, so we
did not reverse policy. You could.
He did. He absolutely did.
In the country now, look, you're comparing the numbers to what? There's a context to what you're saying. Literally, you're picking numbers. And what's the alternate reality where America wasn't involved? Like millions of people starved to death in that country. It's not like.
Yeah. Did he really just explain away South Korea as a capitalist exploitation that didn't really bring any benefit to the people?
It sounds like leftist anti-capitalist Twitter shit. Like,
I'm sorry, but this idea that we look,
you tell that to any South Korean,
you can't. The proof is in the pudding. The government that we created, that we helped bolster, we got Yeltsin reelected. That government faded and collapsed into authoritarianism. That's what we did. That's our influence. If our government was so successful, how come every time we leave and we, you know, we stop, it turns south? Look at Afghanistan, collapsed. 20 years we were there. We couldn't establish a stable government. Couldn't provide basic services to the people.
These are
sorry.
Can I ask something? Right. I just want to right say this because I feel like I understand the anger from both sides. But we still need to have a conversation. So let me ask Walker this. So in the Gulf War, for example, when we saved Kuwait, as I mentioned, I was born in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and all that, you know, we jumped in, we saved, and then we jumped out. You know, nothing happened. These countries still exist. They're doing great. Was that a good thing or bad thing?
I think it was the right decision not to pursue it further.
Yeah.
I think that there are definite costs and benefits to that action. I think that depending on who you are, it's either good or it's either not good. I mean, we did kill civilians.
My point is America did get involved and then get out when they thought that was the best decision.
I think getting out, I think that was the right move. Yeah. I think that if we were going to go in, not pursuing it further than we did was a good call. Not toppling, you know, Saddam was the right call. I think that, you know, if you look at Iraq now, if we leave, the same thing that's happening in Afghanistan is going to happen in Iraq. It's going to, the government will collapse. It's no closer today to having a stable government in Iraq than we were to having a stable government in Afghanistan. I mean, that says a lot about how popular we are in the region. If we were so freaking great and so wonderful, we would see more popular support for and you know, but it turns out that when you bomb weddings and bomb children and kill people, thought experiment.
And because this is an interesting thought experiment, and you know, nobody bats a thousand. Given what you could recognize about your own worldview, do you think in the 30s you would have appeased Hitler or recognized that this was something we should have stopped earlier? Honestly, like, do you think you would have been able? Would your own worldview have allowed you to see that?
Are you comparing the Taliban to Adolf Hitler, who had conquered most of the Western world? I mean, do you think there's an adequate comparison there?
Hitler had, this is prior to him conquering the Western world. This is the point.
What are you talking about?
Churchill was sounding the alarm about Hitler, and then Chamberlain went and said, we have peace in our time. And Churchill said, you're ridiculous, whatever. I mean, I'm not an expert on the history either, but I mean, I know the basic points of it. When Hitler started making moves to get out from under the Versailles Treaty, and people were crying alarm, and other people were saying, no, this is not our thing. And especially in America, you know, we're not getting involved over there. We waited really long. I'm just wondering, do you believe introspectively that your worldview would allow you to see a scenario where, well, actually, in this particular case, I might have to go the other way on that one, because this guy's really dangerous. Maybe when the Ayatollah is talking about Israel.
You think there's an adequate comparison to be made between Nazi Germany, which conquered much of Europe.
He was talking
Iran.
About before. Yeah,
I think there was a comparison to be made between Nazi Germany and Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War. How's that?
I think that's a laughable comparison. I think Nazi that's Germany, a really ahistorical.
Did you hear what I said?
Yeah, Nazi I did.
Germany and what I say?
And Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War. Yeah, I think that is a laughable comparison.
When he took Kuwait, his expressed intention was then to take Saudi Arabia.
He actually did take parts of Saudi Arabia.
So if we and then who knows where that would have stopped, because Pan-Arabism, you know, the idea of uniting all the Arab world under one flag was actually much more in the mainstream than the idea of the Nazis uniting Europe. So no, you're not correct about that. So I mean, you might not agree with the analogy, but to call it laughable is laughable. There's certainly reasonable minds can differ about whether or not Saddam Hussein had Middle Eastern intentions similar to Hitler's European intentions.
I don't care about his intentions.
Hold on, Hitler, you can't grant me that. You are just not
threat to the free God. World. Hitler was a threat to the free world. There's
right,
a difference.
You think you would have seen that at the time when other people didn't?
I have no idea. I wasn't alive at the time. I think that you keep going to these like impossible hypotheticals that don't have a real answer. Do you want to debate? I'm a little confused as to what you're trying to do.
I hate when people say I'm a little confused. You're not confused. That's a slight at me. Like I'm too.
I'm a little confused as to what your goal is with a hypothetical. Like, I don't understand.
I will tell you if you. I will.
Yes, please.
What I'm saying is that you have a worldview which seems to be on automatic, and I'm wondering if you recognize any kind of case by case basis and what the considerations would be as to when, you know, what maybe it's better for America to step up here early because we're going to pay a much bigger price later, like in Germany, where we learned the hard way, and perhaps like what might have happened if we hadn't stopped Saddam Hussein in Kuwait very cheaply with very little loss of life.
I think there's a pretty knee-jerk reaction, if I do say so on your part, to say that my worldview is on automatic. Having strong opinions about something does not mean that the person who has those opinions has not examined that thing and has not, you know, gone over adequately. You may disagree with my opinion on this or that,
was American intervention in World War II too late?
Too late for France, sure. Too late for Poland,
so guys,
yeah.
I think we made our point of
I have family who died in the Holocaust.
Then it should be relatively easy.
You're suggesting that I would have rolled over for Hitler, which I think is a little offensive.
Listen, I'm asking you pretty reasonable questions, and if you don't answer them, Boris, get me out of this, Boris.
I think it's a reasonable hypothetical. I think there were reasonable minds who disagreed, just like you said, during World War II. We turned down, I think, a ship full of Jews at the time in America because we didn't want to get involved in war. And that wasn't, to me, I wouldn't like condemn those people necessarily, even though I do consider it wrong, but there were reasonable minds who disagreed. America had a huge wave of anti-interventionism prior to that, and we didn't want to get involved in stuff overseas. But the question is, when you're analyzing these things individually, and from my perspective, based on your opinions on Russia, it feels very like it's a mainstream Twitter left point of view to me to be always anti-capitalist and to say that.
Do you think the Yeltsin government was successful, Boris?
No, the Yeltsin government wasn't successful. But
so do you think that us propping up the Yeltsin government was a good idea?
Yes. I think
Yeltsin shelled parliament?
Because the alternative reality in the Soviet Union would have spiraled further into dystopia. I lived under it. I came here and know people now who are not oligarchs but are able to make an okay living because they can take work legally from the United States the way that was illegal prior to U.S. involvement. They can take work legally and make more money for their families. I know people that were able to leave because of that. I personally know my parents' lives under both governments. And even though it didn't ultimately succeed, this is a case where, to me, America's involvement seems to be a net benefit. And pro-Putin or against Putin, the alternative to Putin is not a democratically elected leader that's not a strongman. There's a cultural divide here, and unfortunately, a lot of Russia leans towards a strongman. But the reality is that under him, there are still certain things that have improved for Russia, despite the costs.
Hey, yeah, Boris, that's true.
Boris, would you agree with the following? History operates very, very slowly. What's the word? Tectonically, right? And we're not even finished seeing the results exactly of what America's involvement in the Soviet Union. Yes, Putin is a strong man right now, but every day Putin wakes up and his biggest worry are those forces still out there that America set into motion. And the notion that these things have been extinguished and are not something which are still being grappled with and will continue to be grappled with and which may eventually win the day. These things may take a very, very long time, just like the Cold War took a very, very long time to end. And at any time prior to when it ended unpredictably overnight, you had people like Walker who were making the point, oh, come on, you've been wasting your time. You think we're any better off now than we were before? Look at this leader, look at that leader. And then all of a sudden, miraculously, it all crumbled because the ideas matter and because America is there. And
do you think that the U.S. is better off today than it was in 1980?
That the U.S. is better off today in many ways is way better.
In terms of as a country?
In 1980, when the day that Reagan took over, yeah, way better off in every measure, every objective.
Every measure. So.
What measure are we not better off in 1980? January 1st, 1980.
Inequality. We have historic inequality. Unseen in our history. We have the worst inequality today than we've ever had. What?
What kind of
wealth inequality? The worst wealth inequality we've ever had, ever. Well, in our nation's history, worse than the Gilded Age.
It's true that because you have some famously wealthy people like Jeff Bezos, whatever it is, you might be able to show me a bigger disparity. But But does that mean that the average? Would you rather live? I was alive in 1980. The idea of living the way we lived in 1980.
Okay, well, technology improves.
Waiting on gas lines. Double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment, crime rates, every friend I know being mugged, my father being robbed at gunpoint, my stepmother having her head cracked against, like the notion, the New York City, you ever seen the movie Death Wish, Escape from New York? The notion that that is the good old days because we have some trillionaires in this country. And by the way, billionaires, multi-billionaires in this country. And by the way, I wonder if we said now, listen, every billionaire on planet Earth, here's a nice thought experiment. Every billionaire on planet Earth, we are going to invite them now to move to the United States of America. We're going to give a passport to every billionaire on planet Earth, which means that overnight, wealth inequality would get even way worse, right? Would that make America a worse place to live if we brought?
Well, considering that rent is a proportion of income, groceries is a proportion of income have gotten more significant past 4 decades, and this is quantified. You can look this up.
Rent
this,
where? Rent some places.
On average, places on well. Average.
The, okay, your, okay, guys. So here,
you know what?
Yeah, but wait. There's another important metric that you're not factoring in.
It's ridiculous to think that people live better in 1980. And yes, all the technology and all the difference.
I am saying, as a country, are we better off today than we were 4 decades ago? And by many metrics, the answer is a resounding no.
All I can tell you is that people alive in 1980 were afraid that America was done. The mentality of America in 1980 was, we may have come to the very end. The President of the United States went on TV and talked about the malaise. I don't know if he actually said that, but that was the way it was described. My father used to wake me up early to go get gas for him. I mean, it was crazy what was going on.
I know, that's terrible. But we are losing thousands of people every day, and it's just considered a cost.
Okay, so guys, I want to say something. Hold on.
Overall, it's something pandemic. Because
yeah, we've been having a discussion in the last half hour, and it's not going anywhere because everyone is trying to prove that the other person is something. You know, I think we all entitled to our opinions. So I want to really finish up strong with the something that I actually work hard to do. And I think it is the theme of this, which is 9/11 and education. Okay.
All right.
So let's just.
Right. That's where this started.
Yeah. Let's end with this because this is a very interesting study. They asked teenagers from 12 countries what they were taught about 9/11. And these are 5 major questions that, you know, I'll tell you the answers, but also would like to get your opinion on it. So the first thing that the 5 takes from that study that was interesting, and I would like your comment quickly on it each. The first one is, if taught at all, the lesson only reflected each nation's agenda. That's, we're talking about 9/11. Like it's a piece of history. You know exactly what happened, you know, but most of the country, out of the 12 countries that they made the study, maybe 7 of them didn't even study it at all. And each one was curriculum was based on fear, political view, stuff like that. And the only thing that they were teaching them was they just showing the images and then that's it. But, you know, the very interesting, and I think, you know, a lot of people will be surprised at that, is like when they asked the kids what impact did 9/11 have in the world, all the teenagers said that the American response mattered as much as the attack, and they were suspicious or skeptical of the American motives. So, which shows that we're not doing a good job, obviously, educating or teaching or anything. So, any comments on that? Let's start with Walker.
I mean, I think that there's skepticism is justified. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at our adventurism overseas today. Look at what's happening in Yemen, what we're supporting there. I think the conversation that inevitably happens every time another September 11th passes is, you know, America is good, but fundamentally good, but flawed. And I think that conversation misses the human toll that our policies have, because whether or not we're good depends very, you know, good is incredibly subjective. It matters who you are.
So forget about good or bad. Like, let's say, let me rephrase the question to all of you. If you will put the curriculum right now to teach kids, would be that curriculum before specifically 9/11 events?
So my answer to that would be to look at the things that we've done and say, how can we do this better? Or what could we have done differently? What can we do better? If there is another attack, God forbid there's another attack, what can we do differently? How can we respond differently? What are the lessons?
Your curriculum will be what cause?
It's teaching the causes, uh-huh. Looking at those causes and saying, well, and how, in hindsight, you know, hindsight is 2020. I understand that, but what can we do better to live up to the promises of this country that we, you know, and be a better nation? That would be how I would
teach. So how would you describe the event itself? Like that day, what would you say? How would you teach it? And then that same question will go for Boris and Noam.
I mean, horrific. A taste of what happens in the places where we go, mm-hmm. you know?
For or against showing the images as the study showed?
Oh, absolutely for. In fact, when I did some coverage of Yemen, and one of the things that I was pretty insistent on doing with my editors was getting actual images of the violence published. I worked with MoveOn.org to get a video out with those images so that people can actually see. I think that we lose. It's easy to talk in figures and numbers, but when you actually see the people, it's very different.
So for 9/11 specifically,
you show the images of the attack, the
images
and the wars and that ensued. I think that that's important.
Okay, Boris, if you will teach 9/11 to kids, what would you say? What the curriculum should be?
I think I probably agree with. Well, I think we'd all probably be in agreement here as far as the U.S. overextended itself. It changed its goals mid-course. I think those are all valid criticisms and valid lessons from this. I agree with showing images of these horrendous things. Funny enough, I'll bring this up again, as your image of women handing their babies to U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan brought to me the image, the inverse of Soviet soldiers throwing babies out the windows, which is a thing that I heard specifically about when the Beatles were on tour in the Soviet Union propagandizing for the government, along with certain other people in America. It was juxtaposed very commonly by people, and not in public because you couldn't discuss these things in public, but in private, of U.S. soldiers tossing babies out the window while the Potemkin villages were shown to everybody visiting from America so that they could spread these types of messages. I think all these things should be looked at incredibly individually. I think there are times when the U.S. nation builds, like we've used as an example, where the context is entirely different from, I mean, honestly, most of the Middle East just doesn't apply well here. We don't know the culture well enough. At least that's the impression that I get from these different adventures. I think it's, like you said, or like Elise said earlier, I think a lot of the positive messages should be taught. I think you can't have a successful nation long-term or a national identity without focusing on those good things. And if it's to the point where all the bad things outweigh the good, I mean, you're just going to see an inevitable death spiral. So, and I don't believe that. And I don't believe
that. But would 9/11 be taught from a point of view, or like, because we're talking about history here.
In America, it should be taught from the point of view of America. And that doesn't mean without criticism. That doesn't mean we can't give context for the fact that we provided training to bin Laden at one point and that we turned down him giving up to us at one point and everything else. But the perspective is still that, you know, we had 3,000 people die because planes were flown into buildings. You don't have to overthink that part. It's pretty clear that it's a horrendous act, you know?
Walker, do you have kids?
No.
Okay. So, no, I'm the only one to have kids. I was wondering, because part of my question was like the formal and informal education. Like, what do you tell your kids as well? Plus, what would be the curriculum? Like, I don't know if you have a conversation with maybe Mila's old enough. I don't know if the rest of the kids actually. What?
Actually, I know you're not going to like this, but I forgot today was September 11th.
It was yesterday.
I'm kidding. What age kids are you? I think you got cut off for a second. What age?
No, the question to you, since you're the only father here, is the informal education.
When? Right, but what age were you discussing here in terms of teaching kids?
In general, we were talking about teenagers for curriculum, for formal education. What would be the curriculum that you would do?
High school kids?
And then, yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for high school, there's not much to be gained by teaching my daughter about 9/11, except that she's aware of it because they talk about it in school, whatever it is. And
as Boris, you know, she get the wrong information?
No. And as Boris said, I think correctly, that, you know, we were attacked and 3,000 plus people were murdered. And it's not a great lesson to a 9-year-old to start giving them all the mitigating factors of why that murder may not be so terrible. It's wrong to murder 3,000 people. Bin Laden,
I think not terrible isn't a fair way to paint that. No, I'm just to steal man back a little bit.
What's that?
I think describing it that point of view as saying why it's not so terrible isn't a fair way.
Well, when you start to somehow
justify
self-inflicted or deserved or something, when you start to talk too much about like what Bin Laden's beef was, if I introduce that as like, well, 3,000 people were murdered, but you have to understand, you know, this is what we did over there, blah blah blah. It's like, well,
it's not, you have to understand, it's this is what happened,
right? But the fact is,
and then no, this is what happened
in a Machiavellian realpolitik way, we can say, you know what, maybe if we hadn't done this, Bin Laden wouldn't have done that. But what's very, very risky is to have that, this is what I was trying to say, I didn't say it well, that can blur the moral issue here, which is no matter what we did in Saudi Arabia, Bin Laden had no right whatsoever to murder 3,000 Americans because he didn't like it. Period. End of story.
Nobody has a right to murder another human being, and there's no nuance to that.
And I wouldn't want to introduce to a 9-year-old because they might not get it.
What would be the curriculum for high school, which I think
what the curriculum ought to be for a lot of things, including race in this country. It ought to be reading the very best essays by people on both sides of these issues and calling upon these kids randomly to write essays from one point of view or the other, to see if they themselves can make the best arguments from both sides and stop indoctrinating these kids into a point of view and start teaching them how to think. And this is what they don't do anymore. I'm not interested in telling my kids what to think about 9/11, although they will eventually know what I think about it. What will make me proud about them is not when they become good parents, it's when they can generate deep, thoughtful opinions on their own. And they can't do that by being taught that one side is written by smart people and the other side is written by idiots. And that's basically the message they get on every issue now, as I see their curriculum. They put the thumb on the scale as to what they're supposed to think about everything. And I don't like that at all. So that's my answer.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Well, that was very interesting conversation. And I think this is one of the benefit of just, you know, expressing different opinions and different minds.
What a coincidence that it happens in America. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I mean,
where else? You know, I will say, funny example is this was like during the Trump administration. My brother was running a company, and one of his clients was in China, and they had a disagreement there. And I don't really have any gauge. I haven't spoken with enough people or honestly even read about it enough to have like a deep point of view of how much or how little people are indoctrinated there. But they had like a little bit of a political discussion or something popped up to it where they compared the relative oppression in America to the oppression in China. And it was pretty funny because what he recited was basically he was on the phone with her and he's like, really? How about this? Fuck Donald Trump. I hope he gets assassinated and dies. Now you go. And it was just like this funny silence where there was no equivalent. Nobody over there is going to on a telephone line say, fuck Xi Jinping. I hope he gets assassinated and dies. You know,
nobody in the NBA will say it.
Right. You have a lot of nuance to these things. But sometimes when the rubber meets the road, it's not that this is like an all encompassing view, but it sums things up pretty nicely that in the former Soviet Union, I had to be escorted out of my dad's workplace because I repeated something about Grandfather Lenin that my parents said at home. And it was only thanks to the certain reforms happening at that time under Gorbachev that they brought me home and my dad kept his job and God knows what else at the time.
But again, everything is not just black and white. There is obviously a couple of things. So thank you, guys. If you want to share information, Boris, go ahead.
Yeah, at the Boris K on everything.
Anything coming up soon?
Nothing crazy. Tomorrow night I am at, God damn it, now I gotta look at my calendar. Tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, I'm at Studio 111 in Brooklyn for it's going to be a cool video show with comics and all sorts of fun stuff going on.
Guys, no insult. I have to go. Walker, don't. I'm actually nice. I'm sorry I was so testy with you, but you know, it's all fair in war.
That's okay. I'm okay.
Okay. you're a great guest.
I hope I'm all right.
I hope you'll come back again and join us.
Gladly.
So long, everybody.
Yeah. Take care. Walker, you want to share your information and where people can find you?
Yeah, you can read my work in the Daily Poster. If you want to go back and look at my old work, you can go to Paste Magazine.
And your Twitter?
And my Twitter is just @WalkerBragman.
As Walker Bragman.